Ian grimaced in pain, then looked away. Tears were forming in his eyes. "I would go if I could," he added. "But now I think you are our only chance." We heard the sound of big trucks and saw two large troop carriers drive by. "I don't know where to go," I said. "The old monastery is not that far," Yin replied. "They can be reached in a long day's travel. I can get someone to take you." "What am I supposed to do there? You said earlier that I would be tested. What did you mean by that?" "In order to get through the gateway, you will have to fully allow divine energy to flow through you and set your field in the way you have learned. Know this field goes out from you and has an effect on what happens. Most importantly, control your fear images and stay detached. You still fear certain outcomes. You don't want to lose your life." "Of course I don't want to lose my life," I said, almost yelling. "I have a lot to live for." "Yes, I know," he replied gently. "But those are very dangerous thoughts. You have to abandon all thoughts of failing. I can't do that, but I think you can. You have to be sure, with all your faith, that you are going to be saved, that you are going to succeed." He paused to see if I understood. "Anything else?" I asked. "Yes," he said. "If all else fails, continue to affirm that Shambhala is helping you. Look for the..." He stopped, but I knew what he meant. The next morning, I was in the cab of an old four-wheel drive truck, squeezed in between a herdsman and his four-year-old son. Yen had known exactly what to do. In spite of his pain, we had sneaked across several blocks to an old adobe brick house where we were given a hot meal and a place to spend the night. He stayed up late talking to several men. I could only suppose that the men were members of Yen's secret group, but I asked no questions. We had risen early, and minutes later, the farm truck had driven up, and I had climbed aboard. We were now traveling along a snow-covered dirt road, circling ever higher into the mountains. As the truck bounced along, we turned a corner and reached an overlook, where we could see the place where Yin and I had said goodbye. I asked the driver to slow the truck so I could see. To my horror, the whole area below was filled with military vehicles and soldiers. "Wait a minute," I said to the driver. "Yin may need help. We have to stop." The old man shook his head. "Must go. Must go." He and his son talked excitedly in Tibetan, occasionally looking at me as though they knew something I didn't. He sped up the truck, and we traveled through a pass and started down through the mountains. A pang of fear erupted in my stomach. I was torn about what to do. What if Yin had escaped and needed me? On the other hand, I thought I knew what Yin would have wanted. He would have insisted that I go on. I tried to keep my energy up, but part of me wondered if all the talk about gateways and Shambhala might turn out to be just a myth. And even if it was true, why would I be allowed to enter and not someone else like Jampa or Lama Rigdon? Nothing made sense. I shrugged off those thoughts and tried to keep my energy high, gazing out at the snow-covered peaks. I watched closely as we traveled through several small towns, including Dormar. Finally, after eating a lunch of cold soup and dried tomatoes, I fell asleep for a long time. When I awoke, it was late afternoon, and large snowflakes were falling again, soon covering the road with a fresh coating of whiteness. As we continued to travel, the terrain grew ever more mountainous, and I could tell the air was growing thinner. Approaching in the distance was yet another tall range of mountains. That must be the Kunlun Range, I thought, the one Yin had mentioned. Part of me continued to disbelieve that all this was happening, but another knew it was, and that I was alone now, facing the monolithic Chinese presence with all its soldiers and atheistic skepticism. From behind us, I heard the low drone of a helicopter. My heart began to pound, but I kept my alertness. The herdsman seemed oblivious to the threat and drove on for another 30 minutes, then smiled and pointed up ahead. Through the falling snow, I could see the darker outlines of a large stone structure sitting atop one of the first ridges. Several walls on the left side were collapsed. Behind the monastery rose huge spires of snow-covered rock. The monastery was 3 or 4 stories tall, even though its roof had long since rotted away, and I looked closely for a moment for any sign of people or movement. I saw nothing. It seemed to have been completely abandoned for a long time. At the base of the mountain, 500 feet below the monastery, the truck stopped, and the man pointed up toward the ruined structure. I hesitated, looking out at the blowing snow. He gestured again, urging me on with his excited expression. I grabbed the pack Yin had prepared for me from the back of the truck. I started up the hill. The temperature was growing slightly colder, but I hoped that with the tent and sleeping bag, I would not freeze to death. But what about the soldiers? I watched the truck move out of sight and listened carefully, hearing nothing but the wind. I looked around and found a rock stairway up the hill and started to climb. After about 200 feet, I stopped and looked back toward the south. From here, I could see nothing but white mountains for miles. As I approached the monastery, I could see now that it actually wasn't on a hill of its own, but stood on a large precipice extending out from the mountain behind it. The path led right to the opening that was once a large door, and I carefully walked in. Large, huge stones lay scattered around the dirt floor, and I was facing a long hallway that ran the length of the structure. I walked down the hall past several rooms that opened up on both sides of me. Finally, I came to a larger room that had a doorway to the back side of the monastery. In fact, half its rear wall had collapsed, and more stones, some of them as big as tables, lay on the ground outside. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a movement near the collapsed wall. I froze. What was that? Cautiously, I walked to the opening and looked outside in all directions. It was about 100 feet from the door to the sheer rock face of the mountain. No one seemed to be around. As I continued to look, I saw another vague movement also out of the corner of my eye. This time, it was farther away, near the base of the mountain face. A chill ran through me. What was going on? What was I seeing? I thought about grabbing my pack and running back down the hill, but I decided against it. I was definitely frightened, but my energy was remaining strong. I focused as best I could through the falling snow and headed for the cliffs where I thought I had seen the movement. When I arrived, I could find nothing. The cliff walls were laced with vertical crevices, including one very large one that at first looked like a narrow cave. On closer inspection, I saw it was only several feet deep, too shallow for anyone to hide, and filled with snow. I looked around for footprints, and although the snow was 10 or 12 inches thick, I could find none but my own. The snow was falling much harder now, so I walked back to the monastery and found a corner of the room that still had an overhang of stone in place that protected me from the snow and wind. A pang of hunger hit me, and I crunched some carrots as I broke out the small gas stove and heated some freeze-dried vegetable soup Yin had placed in my pack. As they were simmering, I thought about what was happening. There was only an hour left until dark, and I had no idea why I was up here. I looked through my pack and found no flashlight of any kind. Why hadn't Yin packed one? The gas in the stove wouldn't last through the night. I had to find some firewood or yak dung. My mind was already playing tricks on me, I thought. What might happen if I had to spend the entire night up here in total darkness? What if these old walls began to fall in the wind? As soon as I had that thought, I heard a crumbling sound at the far end of the monastery. I walked out to the hall, and just as I looked, I saw a huge stone crash to the ground. Jesus! I said aloud. I have to get out of here. I turned off the stove and grabbed the other gear and ran out the back into the blowing snow. I quickly realized I would have to find shelter, so I ran back to the mountain cliffs, hoping I had missed a crevice or overhang large enough to camp in. When I reached the cliffs, I searched in vain for an opening. None of the crevices were deep enough. The wind howled. At one point, a huge clump of snow fell from one of the rocks and landed at my feet. I looked up at the tons of accumulating snow that was lining the sides of the mountain above me. What if there was an avalanche here? In my mind's eye, I could see the snow rolling down the mountain. Again, as soon as I had that thought, I heard a rumbling sound above me and to the right. I grabbed the gear and ran back toward the monastery just as a thunderous roar filled the air and snow rolled down the mountainside 50 feet away. I ran as fast as I could and collapsed into the snow halfway back to the monastery, terrified. Why was all this happening? With that thought, a memory of Yin came to my mind. He was saying, "At these levels of energy, the effect of your expectations is immediate. You will be tested." I sat up. Of course, this was the test. I wasn't controlling my fear images. I ran back to the old monastery and ducked inside. The temperature was falling rapidly, and I knew I had to risk staying inside. Setting my gear down, I spent several minutes imaging the stones staying in place. A shiver of cold ran through me. Now, I thought, I have to do something about this cold. I pictured myself sitting beside a warm fire. Fuel. I had to find some fuel. I walked out to look over the rest of the monastery. I had only reached the hallway when I was stopped cold in my tracks. I could smell smoke, the smoke of burning wood. Now what? Slowly, I walked down the hallway, looking in each room as I came to them, finding nothing. When there was only one room left, I peered around the doorway. In the corner was a burning campfire and a store of wood. I stepped in and looked around. No one was here. This room had another doorway leading outside and more of a roof overhead. It felt much warmer. But who built this fire? I walked to the outside opening and looked around at the snow. Still no tracks. I was turning around, heading for the door, when in the half-light I saw a tall figure standing at the edge of the doorway. I tried to focus on him directly, but I could see him only at the peripheral edges of my sight. I realized it was the same man I had seen in the snow when Yin had pushed me from the jeep. I tried to focus on him directly again, and he vanished. The hair on the back of my neck stood up, and a chill went through me. I couldn't believe what was happening. Cautiously, I walked through the doorway and peered down the hall in both directions, seeing nothing. I thought again about fleeing the monastery and going down the mountain, but I knew the temperature was still falling fast, and if I did, I would likely freeze to death. My only option was to go get my stuff and stay by this fire. So I retrieved my gear and returned, peering nervously around every corner. As I sat down, a gust of wind whipped the fire and blew ash everywhere, and I watched the flames for a moment as they caught back up. I had imagined a fire, and then it had manifested, but it was too much to believe that my field could be that strong. There was only one explanation. I was being helped. The figure I saw was a Dakini. As eerie as it all was, that realization eased my mind, and I threw more wood on the fire and finished my soup, then unpacked my sleeping bag. After a few minutes, I lay down and fell into a deep sleep. When I awoke, I looked around wildly. The fire had died down and the first light of dawn was emerging outside. The snow was falling just as hard as the night before. Something had awakened me. What? I heard the dull drone of helicopters growing louder, heading toward me. Jumping to my feet, I gathered my things. In seconds, the helicopters were directly overhead, adding to the swirling wind. Without warning, half the monastery began to crumble and fall inward, creating a storm of blinding dust. I felt my way out the back opening and ran outside, abandoning my gear. The blizzard was still blowing horizontal snow, and I could only see a few yards in front of me, but I knew if I continued to run in this direction, I would soon come to the mountain face I had seen the day before. I struggled on until I could see the rocky slope. It was directly in front of me about 50 feet away, but in the dawn light, I knew it shouldn't be this visible. It was as if the mountain was bathed in a soft, slightly amber color, especially near one of the large crevices I had seen before. I stared a moment longer, knowing what it meant, then took off running toward the light as more of the monastery fell in behind me. When I reached the cliff wall, the helicopter seemed to be directly overhead. What was left of the old monastery completely crashed down behind me, shaking the ground and dislodging the snow in the crevice nearest to me, revealing a narrow opening. It was a cave after all. I stumbled through the passageway and into total darkness, feeling my way ahead. I found the back wall and then another opening that was less than 5 feet high. It bent to the right, and I crawled through it, glimpsing the smallest ray of light ahead, far in the distance. I struggled forward. At one point, I tripped over a large rock and fell headfirst onto the dirt and gravel floor, skinning my elbow and arm, but the fading sound of the helicopters drove me onward. I shook off the pain and continued moving in the direction of the light. After I had traveled several hundred feet, I could still see the tiny opening, but it seemed no closer. I continued on for most of an hour, feeling my way toward the tiny illumination ahead of me. Finally, the light seemed to be getting closer, and as I got to within 10 feet of it, I was abruptly met with a blast of warmer air and the fragrance that I had smelled before at the monastery. In the distance somewhere, I also heard a loud, melodious human cry that reverberated through my body, bringing forth an inner warmth and euphoria. Was this the call that Lama Rigdon had mentioned? The call of Shambhala. I climbed up over the last remaining rock and stuck my head through the opening. Before me was an unbelievable sight. I was facing a large pastoral valley and clear blue sky. Beyond the valley were huge, snow-capped mountain peaks. All were strikingly beautiful in the bright sunlight. The temperature was chilly, but temperate, and green plants were growing everywhere. In front of me, the hill sloped gently down toward the valley floor. As I walked through the opening and started down the hill, I felt overwhelmed by the energy of the place and began to have trouble focusing. Lights and colors were swirling together, and I felt myself slumped to my knees. Out of control, I began to roll down the hill. I rolled and rolled, almost as though I was half asleep, losing all sense of time. 7. Entering Shambhala. I felt someone touching me, human hands wrapping me up and carrying me somewhere. I began to feel safe, even euphoric. After a while, I smelled the sweet fragrance again, only now it was all-consuming, filling my consciousness. "Try to open your eyes," a female voice said. As I struggled to focus, I was able to make out a figure of a large woman, perhaps 6.5 feet tall. She was pushing a cup toward my face. "Here," she said, "drink this." I opened my mouth and took in a warm, tasty soup made from tomatoes, onions, and some kind of broccoli that was sweet. As I drank, I realized my taste perception was enhanced. I could discern every flavor precisely. I drank most of the cup, and within moments, my head cleared, and I could again focus on everything around me. I was in a house, or what seemed to be a house. The temperature was warm, and I was lying on a lounger made from a blue-green fabric. The floor was a smooth brown stone tile, and numerous plants in ceramic pots were sitting close by. Yet above me were blue sky and the overhanging branches of several large trees. The dwelling didn't seem to have a roof or outside walls. "You should be feeling better now, but you must breathe," the woman spoke in fluent English. I looked at her, spellbound. She was Asian in appearance, dressed in a colorful, embroidered Tibetan ceremonial dress and soft-looking, simple slippers. Judging from the depth of her gaze and the wisdom in her voice, she was about 40 years of age, but her body and movements gave her the appearance of a much younger person. And while her body was perfectly proportioned and beautifully shaped, every feature was exceptionally large. "You must breathe," she repeated. "I know that you know how to do this, or you wouldn't be here." Finally, I understood what she meant, and began to breathe in the beauty of my surroundings and envisioned the energy coming into me. "Where am I?" I asked. "Is this Shambhala?" She smiled approvingly, and I couldn't believe the beauty of her face. It was slightly luminous. "Part of it," she replied. "What we call the rings of Shambhala. Farther to the north are the holy temples." She went on to tell me that her name was Ani, and I introduced myself as she looked down on me. "Tell me how you got here," she said. In a rambling way, I told her the whole story, beginning with a brief description of my talk with Natalie and Will, the insights, and my trip to Tibet, including meeting Yin and Lama Rigdon, and hearing about the legends, and then finally, finding the gateway. I even mentioned my perceptions of the light, apparently the work of the Dakini. "Do you know why you are here?" she asked. I looked at her for a moment. "All I know is that I was asked to come by Will and that it was important to find Shambhala. I was told there is knowledge here that is needed." She nodded and looked away, thinking. "How did you learn such good English?" I asked, feeling weak again. She smiled. "We speak many languages here. Have you seen a man named Wilson James?" "No," she said. "But the gateway can enter the rings at other places. Perhaps he is here somewhere." She had walked over to the potted plant and was pulling one of them closer to me. "I think you must rest a while. Try to absorb some energy from these plants. Set in your field the intention that their energy is coming in, and then go to sleep." I closed my eyes following her instructions, and within moments I drifted off. Sometime later, a swooshing noise aroused me. The woman was standing in front of me again. She sat down on the edge of the lounger. "What was that noise?" I asked. "I came in from outside."
"Through the glass?"
"It's not really glass. It's an energy field that looks just like glass, but you can't break it. It hasn't been invented in the outer cultures yet."
"How is it created? Is it electronic?"
"Partially, but we have to participate mentally to activate it." I looked out at the landscape beyond the house. There were other dwellings spread out over the gently rolling hills and meadows all the way down to the flat valley. Some had clear outer walls, like Ani's house. Others seemed to be made of wood in a uniquely designed Tibetan style. All were nestled unobtrusively into the landscape. "What about those houses out there with different architecture?" I asked. "They're all created by a force field," she said. "We don't use wood or metals any longer. We just create what we want with the fields." I was fascinated. "What about the internal construction, water, and electricity?" "We do have water, but it manifests right out of the water vapor in the air, and the fields power everything else we need." I looked outside again, disbelieving. "Tell me about this place. How many people are here?"
"Thousands.
Shambhala is a very big place." Interested, I swung my legs off the lounger and put my feet on the floor, but experienced severe lightheadedness. My vision blurred. She got up and reached behind the lounger and handed me more soup. "Drink this and breathe in the plants again," she said. I complied, and eventually my energy returned. As I took in more air, everything became even brighter and more beautiful than before, including Ani. Her face had become more luminous now, glowing from within, exactly the way I had seen Will look at times in the past. "My God," I said, looking around. "It's a lot easier to raise your energy here than in the outer cultures," she commented, "because everyone is giving energy to everyone else and setting a field for a higher cultural level." She said the phrase, "higher cultural level," with emphasis, as though it had some greater meaning. I couldn't take my eyes off the surroundings. Every form, from the potted plants close to me, to the colors of the floor tile, to the lush green trees outside, seemed to glow from within. "All of this seems unbelievable," I stammered. "I feel as if I'm in a science fiction movie." She looked at me seriously. "Much science fiction is prophetic. What you see is simply progress. We're human, just like you, and we're evolving in the same way that you in the outer cultures will eventually evolve, if you don't sabotage yourselves." At that moment, a young boy of about 14 ran into the room, nodding politely to me, and said, "Pima called again." She turned to him. "Yes, I heard. Will you get our jackets? And one for our guest." I couldn't take my eyes off the boy. His demeanor seemed much older than he looked, and his appearance was familiar. He reminded me of someone, but I couldn't remember who. "Can you come with us?" Annie said, breaking my stare. "This may be important for you to see." "Where are we going?" I asked. "To a neighbor's house, just to check things. She thinks she conceived a child a few days ago, and she wants me to check her out." "Are you a doctor?" "We don't really have doctors, because we no longer have the illnesses you are familiar with. We have learned how to keep our energy above that level. I help people monitor themselves and extend their energy and keep it that way." "Why do you say it's important for me to see?" "Because you happen to be here at this moment." She looked at me as though I was dense. "Certainly, you must understand the synchronistic process." The young boy returned, and I was introduced. His name was Tashi. He handed me a bright blue jacket. It looked exactly like an ordinary parka, except for the stitching. In fact, there was no stitching at all. It was as if the pieces of fabric were simply pressed together. And surprisingly, even though the jacket felt just like cotton, it weighed almost nothing. "How are these made?" I asked. "They're force fields," Ani said as she and Tashi walked through the wall with a whoosh. I tried to follow and bounced back from what felt like a solid piece of plexiglass. The boy outside laughed. With another swoosh, Ani came back in, also smiling. "I should have told you what to do," she said. "I'm sorry. You must visualize the force field opening for you. Just intend it." I gave her a skeptical glance. "Just see it opening in your mind, and then walk through." I did as she described, and then walked forward. I could actually see the field open up. It looked like a distortion in the space, something like the heat rays one can see on a highway in the sun. With a swoosh, I walked through onto the outside walkway. Ani followed. I shook my head. Where was I? Following Tashi, we traveled along a winding path that moved gradually down the slope of the hill. As I glanced back, I saw that Ani's house was almost totally hidden by trees, and then something else grabbed my attention. Near the house was a square, black, metallic-looking unit the size of a large suitcase. "What is that?" I asked Ani. "That's our power unit," she replied. "It helps us heat and cool the house and set the force fields." I was totally confused. "What do you mean, helps you?" She was walking in front of me as we continued down the slope. She slowed down and let me walk up beside her. "The power unit by the house doesn't create anything by itself. All it does is amplify the prayer field you know about to a higher level so that we can then manifest what we need directly." I looked at her askance. "Why does this sound so fantastic?" Ani asked, smiling. "I told you, it is merely progress." "I don't know," I said. "During all this time of trying to reach Shambhala, I guess I never gave much thought to what it would be like here. I guess I thought it was going to be just a group of high lamas in meditation somewhere. This is a culture with technology. It's fantastic." "It's not the technology that matters. It's how we have used the technology to help build our mental powers that is important." "What do you mean?" "All this is not as outlandish as you think. We merely discovered the lessons of history. If you look closely at the human story, you can see that technology has always been just a precursor for what could eventually be done with the human mind alone. Think about it. Throughout history, people created technology to enhance their ability to act and to be comfortable in the world. In the beginning, it was only pots to hold our food and tools to dig with, then more sophisticated houses and buildings. To create these items, we dug up ores and minerals and fashioned them into what we envisioned in our minds. We wanted to travel more effectively, so we invented the wheel and then vehicles of various sorts. We wanted to fly, so we made airplanes that helped us do it. We wanted to communicate more rapidly over great distances anytime we wished, and so we invented wires and telegraphs, telephones, wireless radios, and television to let us see what was happening in another location. She looked at me questioningly. See the pattern? Humans invented technology because we wanted to reach out to various places and connect with more people, and we knew in our hearts that it was possible for us to do that. Technology has always been just a stepping stone to what we can do ourselves. What we knew was our birthright. But all these things do what humans alone can't do. The true role of technology has been to help us build the faith that we can do all these things ourselves with our inner power. So in the early history of Shambhala, we began to evolve technology to consciously serve the development of the human mind. We realized the true potential of our prayer fields and began to recraft our technology to merely amplify our fields. Here in the rings, we still use the amplification devices, but we are right on the brink of being able to turn them off and just use our prayer fields to manifest everything we need or want to do. Those in the temples can already do this. I wanted to ask her more questions, but as we rounded a bend, I saw a wide creek running down the hill to our right. The sound of rushing water echoed ahead. "What's that sound?" I asked. "There's a waterfall up there," she said. "Do you feel the need to see it?" I didn't quite know what she meant. "Do you mean intuitively?" I asked. "Of course I mean intuitively," she replied, smiling. "We live by intuition." Tashi had stopped and was looking back. Ani turned to him. "Why don't you go tell Pima we are coming?" He smiled and ran on ahead. We climbed the rocky slope to our right, moving closer to the stream, and pushed through some thicker, smaller trees until we came to the edge of the water. The stream was 25 feet wide and flowing briskly. Through the limbs to our left, I could see the water going over a ledge. Ani motioned for me to follow. We walked along the stream and down several tiers of rock until we were just below the falls. From here, we could see the 50-foot drop into a large pool below. A movement caught my eye, and I moved down to the edge of the rock to look down. To my surprise, through the mist and spray at the end of the pool, I could see two people walking toward each other, both surrounded by a soft, pinkish-white light. Even though the light wasn't very bright, it was remarkably dense, especially around their shoulders and hips. I strained to make out the full outlines of the two people, and when I did, I realized that they were naked. "So, this is what you brought me up here to see?" Ani asked, amused. I couldn't take my eyes off of what was happening. I knew that I was watching the energy fields of a man and a woman. As they approached each other, their fields merged until they were embracing. Finally, ever so slowly, I saw another light forming in the midsection of the woman. After a few minutes, they separated and the woman felt her stomach. The tiny light grew brighter, and the two embraced again and seemed to be talking, but I could hear nothing but the waterfall. Without warning, both people simply disappeared. I realized that they had been making love, and I became embarrassed. "Who were those people?" I asked. "I didn't recognize them," Ani replied, "but they are from the region, somewhere." "It looked as though they conceived a child," I said. "Do you think they intended to?" She burst into a chuckle. This isn't the outer cultures. Of course they intended to conceive. At these levels of energy and intuition, bringing the soul onto the earth is a very deliberate process. How did they disappear like that? They traveled there by projecting themselves mentally through a travel field. The amplification device allows us to do that. We found that the same electromagnetic field that sends television pictures can be used to actually link the space of a remote location to the space where we are. When we do that, we can simply look at a scene wherever we want, or actually walk through to the other site using our amplified prayer field. The wormhole theorists in the outer cultures are already working on such theories now, only they aren't fully conscious of what it will lead to. I just looked at her, trying to absorb the new information. "You look overwhelmed," she said. I nodded, managing a smile. "Come on, I'll show you at Pima's." When we arrived, the house was just like Ani's, except that it was built into the side of a hill and had different furniture. I noticed an identical black box outside, and we entered through the force field just as before. We were met by Tashi and another woman who introduced herself as Pima. Pima was taller than Ani and slimmer. Her hair was jet black and long. She wore only a long white dress and was smiling, but I realized that something was not quite right. She asked to see Ani alone, and they walked into another room, leaving Tashi and me sitting in a living area. I was about to ask him what was wrong when I felt an electricity in the air behind me. I saw the rippled distortion open just like the one I'd seen in the force field around Ani's house, only this time it appeared in the middle of the room. I blinked, trying to grasp what was happening. As I focused, I saw a field with small plants through the distortion, as though it were a window. To my surprise, a man walked through the opening into the room. Tashi stood up and introduced us. The man's name was Dorji. He nodded politely to me and asked where Pima was. Tashi pointed toward the bedroom. "What just happened?" I asked Tashi. He looked at me with a smile. "Pima's husband arrived from his farm. Can't some of you do this in the outer cultures?" I told him briefly about the rumors and myths about yogis who could project themselves to distant locations. "But I've never personally seen anything like this," I added, trying to regain my composure. "How is it done, exactly?" "We visualize the place where we want to go, and the amplifier helps us to create a window into that place right in front of us. It also creates an opening back in the other direction as well. That's how we could see where he was before he came through."
"And the amplifier is that black box outside?"
"That's right."
"And all of you can do this?"
"Yes, and it is our destiny to do it without the amplifier." He stopped and stared at me, then asked, "Will you tell me about the culture you came from in the outer world?"
Before I could answer, we heard a voice from the bedroom declare, "It's happened again." Tashi and I looked at each other. After a few minutes, Ani led Pima and her husband out of the bedroom, and they all sat down in the living room beside us.
"I was so certain that I was pregnant," Pima said. "I could see the energy and feel it momentarily, and then within a few minutes it disappeared. It must be the transition."
Tashi was looking at her intensely, totally fascinated. "What do you think happened?" I asked.
"We have intuited," Ani said, "that it is some kind of parallel pregnancy and that the child has gone somewhere else."
Dorji and Pima looked at each other for a long moment.
"We'll try again," Dorji said. "It almost never happens twice in one family."
"We must be going," Ani said, standing up and embracing the couple. Tashi and I followed her out through the force field. I was still overwhelmed. In some ways, the culture here seemed ordinary. In other ways, totally fantastic. I tried to take it all in as Ani led us a dozen or so yards to a beautiful rock ledge overlooking the massive green valley below. "How could there be a temperate environment this large in Tibet?" I blurted out. Ani smiled.
The temperature is controlled with our fields, and to those with less energy, we are invisible. Although the legends say that will begin to change when the transition grows near. I was startled.
You know about the legends? I asked.
Ani nodded. Of course. Chambala is the original holder of the legends, as well as many prophecies all through history. We help bring spiritual information into the outer cultures. We also knew that it was only a matter of time before you began to find us.
Me? Personally? I asked.
No, anyone from the outer cultures. We knew that as you generally raised your level of energy and awareness, you would begin to take Shambhala seriously, and that some of you would be able to come here. That is what the legends say. At the time of Shambhala's shift or transition, people from the outer cultures will arrive, and not just the occasional adepts from the east who have always found us periodically, but people from the west as well, who will be helped to come here.
You said the legends predict a transition. What is that?
The legends say that as the outer cultures began to understand all of the steps to extending the human prayer field, how to connect with divine energy and let it flow through with love, how to set your field to bring on the synchronistic process and uplift others, and how to anchor this strong field with detachment, then the rest of what we do here in Shambhala will become known.
You're talking about the rest of the fourth extension.
She looked at me knowingly. Yes, that is, after all, what you're here to see.
Can you tell me what it is?
She shook her head. You must take it one step at a time. You must first realize where humanity is going, not intellectually, but with your eyes and feelings. Shambhala is the model for that future.
I nodded as I looked at her.
It's time for the world to know what human beings are capable of, where evolution is taking us. Once you grasp it fully, you will be able to extend your field even more, grow even stronger.
She shook her head and added,
But understand that I don't have all the information about the fourth extension. I will be able to guide you through some of the next steps, but there is more that is known only by those at the temples.
What are the temples? I asked.
They are the heart of Shambhala, the mystical place you imagined. It's where the real work of Shambhala is done.
Where are they located?
She pointed north across the valley at a strange circular group of mountains in the distance. Over there, past those peaks, she said.
During the time we were talking, Tashi was silent, listening to every word.
Ani looked at him and brushed back his hair with her hand. It was my intuition that Tashi would have been called to the temples by now, but he seems to be more interested in life in your world.
I jerked awake, sweating. I had been dreaming of walking through the temples with Tashi and someone else on the verge of understanding the fourth extension. We were in a maze of stone structures, most of them sandy bronze, but out in the distance was a temple that appeared bluish in color. A person in dramatic Tibetan attire was standing outside. In the dream, I began running from the Chinese official I had seen several times before. He was chasing me through the temples, and they were being destroyed. I was hating him for what he was doing. I sat up and tried to focus, barely remembering the walk back to Ani's house. I was now in one of her bedrooms, and it was morning. Tashi was sitting in front of the bed, on a big chair, staring at me. I took a deep breath and tried to calm down.
What's wrong?
He asked.
Just a scary dream, I said. Will you tell me about the outer cultures?
Can't you just go there through a window or wormhole or whatever you call it?
He shook his head. No, this is not possible, even at the temples. My grandmother intuited that it could be done, but no one has succeeded because of the difference in the energy levels between the two places. Those at the temples can see what is happening in the outer cultures, but that's all.
Your mother seems to know a lot about the outer world.
We get our information from those who reside in the temples. They come back often, especially when they sense that someone is ready to join them.
Join them?
Almost everyone here aspires to acquire a place in the temples. It is the greatest honor and an opportunity to influence the outer cultures.
As he spoke, his voice and level of maturity reminded me of someone 30 years old. Even though he was large, it was disconcerting to look at his 14-year-old face.
How about you? I asked. So you want to go to the temples?
He smiled and looked toward the other room as though he didn't want his mother to overhear.
No, I keep thinking about somehow going to the outer cultures. Will you tell me about them?
For half an hour, I told him as much as I could about the current state of affairs in the world, the way most people live, the diets most ate, the struggle to institute democracy around the globe, the corrupting influence of money on government, the environmental problems. Far from being alarmed or disappointed, he soaked it all in with enthusiasm. Presently, Ani came into the room, sensed that there was a conversation of note going on, and paused. Neither of us said anything, and I slumped back down on the pillow. She looked me over.
"We've got to get more energy into you," she remarked. "Come with me."
I put on my clothes and met her in the living area, then followed her outside and around to the back of the house. Here, the trees were very large and spaced about 30 feet apart. Between them was a coarse grass like sage and dozens of other plants that looked like huge asparagus ferns. She urged me to move my body, and I attempted the exercises Yin had showed me.
"Now, sit here," she said when I finished, "and raise your energy again."
As she sat beside me, I began to breathe in and focus on the beauty around me, visualizing the energy coming into me from within. As before, the colors and shapes began to stand out very easily. I looked over at Ani and saw an expression of deeper wisdom on her face.
"That's better," she said. "You still weren't all here yesterday when we visited Pima. Do you remember what happened?"
"Sure," I replied. "Most of it."
"Do you remember what happened when she thought she had conceived?"
"Yes."
"One moment, it seemed to have been there, and then it was gone."
"What do you think happened?" I asked.
"No one really knows. These disappearances have been occurring for a long time. In fact, it began with me 14 years ago. At that time, I was sure I was pregnant with twins, a boy and a girl. And then, in an instant, one of them was gone. I gave birth to Tashi, but I've always felt that his sister was alive somewhere. Since then, couples here have routinely had the same experience. They feel sure that they conceived, and then suddenly they realize their wombs are empty. All of them go on to have other births, but they never forget what happened. This phenomenon has been occurring with regularity throughout Shambhala all these 14 years. She paused for a moment, then said, "It has something to do with the transition, maybe even with you being here."
I looked away. "I don't know."
"Aren't you having any intuitions?"
I thought for a minute, and then remembered the dream. I was about to tell her about it, but I couldn't decide what it meant, so I didn't.
"Not really any intuitions," I said. "Just a lot of questions." She nodded, waiting.
"How does the economy work here? What do most people do with their time?"
"We have evolved to a place where we no longer use money," Ani explained, "and we no longer manufacture or build items like in the outer cultures. Tens of thousands of years ago, we came from cultures that made the things they needed, like you do. But as I told you, we gradually came to understand that the true destiny of technology was to be used to develop our mental and spiritual abilities."
I felt the soft sleeve of my parka. "You mean everything you have is a created energy field?"
"That's right."
"What keeps it together?"
"Once created, these fields last for as long as the energy is not disrupted by negativity of some kind."
"What about food?"
food can be created in the same way, but we found that food is best grown by individuals in a natural process. Food plants respond to our energy and give it back to us. Of course, we no longer have to eat very much to stay vibrant. Most in the temples don't eat at all. What about power? How are the amplifiers powered? Energy is free. A long time ago, we discovered a device using processes that you would call cold fusion. It created virtually free energy for our culture, which liberated us from spoiling the environment and enabled us to automate our mass production of goods. Gradually, all our time became focused on our spiritual paths, on synchronistic perception, and on discovering new truths about our existence and providing this information to others. As she spoke, I recognized that she was describing a human future I first learned about in the 9th and 10th insights. As we developed spiritually here in Shambhala, she went on, we began to understand that human purpose on this planet was to evolve a culture that is spiritual in all its aspects. And then we realized that we had a greater power within us to help us accomplish what needed to be done. We learned the prayer extensions and used them to further evolve our technology, as I've already explained, to help facilitate this creative power. At this point, we live simply in nature, and the only technology that remains are these units that help us mentally create everything else we need. Did all of that evolution take place right here? I asked. No, not at all, she said. Shambhala has moved many times. Her statement shocked me for some reason, and I questioned her further. Oh, yes, she clarified. Our legends are very old and come from many sources. All the myths of Atlantis and the Hindu legends of Meru stem from old civilizations that really existed in the past, where the early evolution of Shambhala worked itself out. Developing our technology was the most difficult step, because to place technology fully in the service of our individual spiritual development, everyone must move to a point where spiritual understanding is more important than money and control. That takes some time, because people who are locked up in fear and think they personally need to manipulate the course of human evolution with their egos often desire to use advances in technology in negative ways to control others. In many early civilizations, a few controllers tried to subvert the use of the amplification machines by trying to use them to monitor and control other people's thoughts. Many times, these attempts ended in war and mass destruction, and humanity had to start all over again. The outer cultures face this problem right now. There are people who want to control everyone else by using surveillance, embedded chips, and brainwave scans. What about the artifacts of these ancient cultures you're speaking about? Why has almost nothing ever been found? Continental drift and ice have buried much of it. And then, once a culture progresses to a point where material goods are being created mentally, if anything goes wrong and a wave of negativity brings the energy down, it simply all disappears. I took a breath and shrugged. Everything she said made perfect sense, yet at the same time, it was utterly disconcerting. It was one thing to hypothesize human civilization evolving toward a spiritual future. It was quite another to find oneself immersed in a culture that had already reached it. Ami moved closer. Just remember that what we have done is the natural course of human evolution. We are ahead of you, but because we have done what we've done, the way can be easier for you in the outer cultures. She paused, and I broke into a grin. Your energy looks much better now, she said. I don't think I've ever felt this alert. She nodded. As I said before, it's the level of energy the individuals here in Shambhala maintain. It's contagious. There are so many people here who know how to bring energy into themselves and project it outward to others that it creates a multiplying effect, where everyone takes in the prayer energy they have received from others and sends it out to everyone else again. Do you see how it grows? All the assumptions and expectations of everyone in a culture flow together and make one big cultural prayer field. The general level any culture achieves is determined almost solely by how conscious its members are about, first, the existence of their prayer fields in general, and then, second, how to extend them consciously. When the extensions are finally practiced, the energy level soars. If everyone in the outer cultures knew how to bring in energy and flow it out, making the prayer extensions a priority, they could achieve the level we have here at Shambhala just like that. She snapped her fingers for emphasis, then added, "That's what we are working on at the temples. We use our prayer extensions to help raise the awareness in the outer cultures. We've done this for thousands of years." I considered her words, then asked, "Tell me everything you know about the fourth extension." She was silent a moment longer, staring at me very seriously. "You know, you must take it one step at a time," she replied. "You were helped, but in order to get here, you had to know the first three extensions and part of the fourth. You must stop now and understand exactly how the extensions actually work. When an extension is completed, one's energy reaches out farther and becomes stronger. This occurs because when you send your energy out to bring in synchronistic experiences and uplift others, and when you anchor this energy with detachment and faith, you are promoting the divine plan. And the more you can act and think in harmony with the divine, the stronger your power gets. Do you see? There is a built-in safety device, as you've no doubt seen. God is not going to turn up the power in you unless you are on the same page with universal intention." She touched my shoulder. "So, what you have to do now is get clearer about where humanity is supposed to go, how overall human culture must evolve. It is time for this to happen. That is why you and others are finally seeing and understanding Shambhala. This is the next step in the fourth extension. You must grasp the intended future of humanity. Already, you've grasped how we have mastered technology and placed it in the service of our inner spiritual evolution. Experiencing this extends your energy out farther, because you can now set this expectation into your prayer field. It is important to understand how this works. You already know how to send a field out in front of you as you walk through this world, and you know how to set it to increase energy and synchronistic flow in yourself and others. You extend your field another step when you not only visualize your field of lifting the people around you into their higher intuitions, but do it with a certainty of where everyone's higher intuitions, yours and theirs, are leading. Toward an ideal spiritual culture like the one you see here in Shambhala. When you do this, it helps them find their part to play in this evolution." I nodded, anxious for more information. "Don't go too fast," she cautioned. "You have not yet seen all of how we live here. Not only have we mastered technology, we have also restructured our world to focus entirely on spiritual evolution, on the mysteries of existence, on the life process itself."